It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an oncologist says that by studying which animals do and don't get cancer, we may be able to unlock the secret to better treatment or even prevention for people.
First, a new study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that the teen birth rate is at an all-time low in the United States.
Wisconsin has seen some of the biggest declines in teen births in recent years. Nicole Angrisano joins us now. She's Vice President of Community Impact for the United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County, which leads the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Initiative. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before we look at some of the local numbers, this new information out from the CDC saw an 8% decrease in the teen birth rate in 2015, and that's not a one-off. There was a record decrease in 2014 as well. What do you see as behind these dramatic declines in teen pregnancy and teen childbirth?
Fantastic news, first of all, and so many people all over the country have been working on this. And I think what we're seeing now are that young people who have been given access to evidence-based information, who have been given opportunities to have improved healthcare access, are really making better choices. We think that two things are at play here. One, young people are delaying sexual intercourse until they're older, and that's bearing out in some youth risk behavior surveys. And two, those young people that are sexually active are using at an increased rate contraception.
And it's not just any contraception. I understand some people are looking at a game changer being this, long-acting reversible contraception, or LARC is how people have been abbreviating it. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. Well, you know, even adults with best intentions have trouble maintaining a medication schedule. So we know that when contraception is not automatic, meaning you have to take a daily pill or you have to think about accessing a condom, then, you know, the rates of use are not as high as they are with a long-acting reversible contraceptive device, which can, quite frankly, be inserted or injected and then forgotten about until it's time to renew or make a different plan.
Now, how are we looking here in Wisconsin when it comes to teen birth rates?
We're looking fantastic. First of all, while the rate has dropped nationally, I think we really have to give a shout-out to the Milwaukee community. The teen birth rate has dropped over 40% nationally in the past decade, which is extraordinary. The teen birth rate in Milwaukee has dropped 54% in that same period, and that's really because of the extraordinary community partners who have worked together for 10 years diligently to address this issue. But I think we need to be honest, which is that we still have too many young people getting pregnant. That's not unique to Milwaukee or Wisconsin or the United States. And the other issue, and I think it needs to be discussed, are the disparities. As a state, Wisconsin fares quite well in these data points and in these statistics, but Milwaukee still struggles. And although we've made excellent strides, we have a lot more work to do.
Talking to Nicole Angrisano with the United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County, which leads the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Initiative. New numbers out from the CDC show another year in a row of declining birth rates among teens. Wisconsin, a similar story, maybe even better in that decline. Nicole, you mentioned the work being done in the Greater Milwaukee area. What on the ground are your organization and others doing that you think has led to these even more dramatic declines in the Milwaukee area?
Well, I think first and foremost, we used a collective impact model and we drove human and financial capital towards one goal. The first goal that we set was to reduce births to teens by 46% by 2015. To do that, we invested in a number of strategies, including public awareness, evidence-based education, faith community strategies, and a really, really robust program within Milwaukee Public Schools, which is our state's largest school system. All of those things working in concert drove towards these incredible data points that you're seeing today. So I think it was the breadth of it, and it was the fact that it was a diverse group of people coming together. So when I talk about, you know, who's at the table, and I use, you know, phrases like all hands on deck, I really mean that, because we had and continue to have 10 years into this initiative business leaders, faith leaders, community educators, school teachers, we have parents, we have, I think most critically, the youth themselves who have worked diligently on this issue as peer mentors and educators. So we've tried a lot of different things because we knew it wasn't a one-size-fits-all solution.
A lot of times when a community is trying to deal with an issue, whatever the issue, gun violence, teen birth rate, anything like that, it's hard to take that all hands on deck approach. I've talked to people organizing communities frustrated that there's a little effort over here, but it's out of touch with this effort. Hard to get people to show up at the meetings. What is it? What is it that got people rallied around this effort that appears to have paid off?
Well, that's a great observation. And certainly we recognize how fortunate we are. And I think there's a number of things at play. One, I have to acknowledge Bevan Baker and Betsy Brenner, who have been the co-chairs, the community leaders of this initiative since day one, and their commitment and ongoing attendance and perseverance. They've set the tone, right? We had recently our 40th quarterly meeting, so we meet every 3 months, our 40th meeting, and the group that was there, some of them have been there since day one, some of them have joined us later in the pathway, but they are as engaged and committed as they ever have been. And I think the other thing we did really well was that we made this issue appeal to everyone, regardless of perhaps what side of the aisle they sit on. And what I mean by that is you and I might think about teen pregnancy or teen births in a different way than another family or dyad might. What we made sure people understood were the cost of teen pregnancy, not just from a social justice lens, not just from an education lens, but also from a financial lens. And by appealing to people where they were, by framing this issue in a way where we could talk about it differently with different audiences, we made room for everyone to contribute. And I think that's often missing. There's often an approach which is you have to get on board and you have to do it this way or, you know, my way or the highway. And with some of these issues, particularly issues that are steeped in potential controversy, that have cultural implications, that have maybe even racial implications, we have to be really thoughtful and careful about making sure there's room for everyone.
Yeah, a controversy that comes up all the time when we talk about teen pregnancy, teen sexual activity, is whether it should be abstinence only or it should be some form of education that includes contraceptive education. Is this something that has been a roadblock, a stumbling block for this effort in the Milwaukee area?
You know, it's something we've had to address over and over again. And I think one of the reasons we have to is I think people have sort of created this false dichotomy between abstinence and birth control as though it's either or. And what we believe and what we've always advocated for is something we refer to as comprehensive sexual education, which includes very direct and specific information about abstinence. You and I and the listeners know the only 100% way to stay either pregnancy-free or STI-free is to abstain from sexual contact. But in the absence of that, when we have young people that we know are disclosing that they're already sexually active, we know that there are young people who have been victims of sexual violence or in relationships against their will, we feel we have a responsibility to make sure that those young people have access to information and access to the kind of evidence-based and factual-based information that will allow them to have some autonomy over their choices.
It sounds like you exceeded that goal in reducing the teen pregnancy rate, the teen birth rate in the Milwaukee area. What's next? What's the next goal? What's the next tactic that you're working on to try to hit that goal?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've been so proud of in the 10 years that we've been working on this is we haven't become complacent and we haven't rested on perceived laurels. And so when we exceeded this goal, our original goal of 46%, rather than sort of, you know, declare that victory was ours and move on to the next issue, instead we rather audaciously set a new goal that was to reduce the rate again by 50% by 2023. So we are continuing to work every day. And one of the reasons is that every day there's new 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. It's not as though you solve this issue and then you stop talking about it. There are young people coming of age every day. There are people moving in and out of communities. There are kids going to different schools. We need to make sure that we continue to provide consistent, solid information to young people across generations, not just one and done.
Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Nicole Angrisano, Vice President of Community Impact at United Way of Greater Milwaukee and Waukesha County, talking about the decline in teen birth rates, according to new data from the CDC. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Food Friday, our guests say that every dish should be prepared with respect, purity, and tranquility. We'll hear stories and recipes from a Vietnamese family kitchen.
Right now, a cure for cancer has been the medical holy grail for many years. Our knowledge, understanding, and available treatments have increased a lot, but there's still a long way to go.
We recently learned about a new concentrated effort for finding a cure for cancer. A cancer moonshot is what the White House has called it, after the concerted effort that put a human being into space.
Our next guest thinks that there are answers to be found by studying cancer in the animal world and learning how different species develop and fight cancer.
Dr. James Welsh is a medical director of radiation oncology at the Stritch School of Medicine at Loyola University Chicago, and he's the author of the new book, Sharks Get Cancer, Mole Rats Don't, How Animals Could Hold the Key to Unlocking Cancer Immunity in Humans, and he'll be at a Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison this Sunday, June 5th at 2 o'clock. Dr. Welsh, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So you want to look at animals to get a better handle on the potential to fight cancer in humans. Why look to the animal kingdom?
Well, there are some very interesting observations in the animal kingdom that I believe could be very instructive when it comes to human clinical cancer care. One example that really stood out was the fact that there are contagious cancers in certain animals. And contagious cancers just shouldn't be, because the immune system should prevent any cancer from being transplanted from one animal to another in the first place. But in dogs, there is a contagious cancer that initially progresses and then subsequently regresses in most cases. That subsequent regression is very, very intriguing because, after all, that type of regression is what we would like to see happen for our human cancer patients. How is it that the dog is undergoing that spontaneous regression? And is there anything that we can learn from studying that example? So that's really what got me going.
Well, right in drawing from the title of your book, Naked Mole Rats, most of us probably haven't seen one, and that's for the best. They're not the most attractive critters, but they appear to be immune to cancer. What do we know about why that is and how we could eventually maybe draw from that to treat cancer or prevent it in humans?
Very interesting. Naked mole rats do seem to be largely impervious to cancer. And I have to explain that although the title of my book is Sharks Get Cancer, Mole Rats Don't, after it was published, only maybe a week or two later, it was discovered that a couple of mole rats did wind up getting cancer.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not 100%, they're not 100% immune to cancer. But they are very, very resistant to malignant disease. The way they do it is through an interesting biochemical phenomenon wherein their cells are physically spaced a bit further from each other than in other animals, and they tend to be less likely to clump together. And cells that are less likely to clump are less likely to get malignancies down the road. Additionally, there are some other mechanisms that make them resistant to cancer as well. But it's not the naked mole rat that seems to be the one that's going to provide a clue to human cancer care. It's the blind mole rat, because in the blind mole rat, there is an immune mechanism, meaning that the immune system wakes up whenever there are malignant cells and causes those malignant cells to die. And that's very important. And I think it's something that maybe we could replicate in human cancer patients.
Well, you also write about mice. Apparently, in some mice, it's possible to activate a cancer-fighting gene, which can trigger a big immune response, which can fight the cancer. And it's been pretty successful in some trials. What does that look like in humans?
Well, so far that hasn't gotten to the stage where we can really say anything definitive about the efficacy in people yet. But one of the most amazing observations I've ever come across was when I was studying certain mice that seemed to be impervious to a specific type of cancer. These mice were being studied for liver and lipid metabolism studies, and one of the mice just wasn't getting the cancer that it was expected to get when it was injected with these certain cells. They increased the dose, they quadrupled it, increased it 100-fold, 1,000-fold, and introduced millions of cells that should have guaranteed that that mouse would have succumbed to the cancer. It didn't. That cancer-resistant mouse was bred and subsequently became nicknamed Mighty Mouse. Hmm. The amazing thing was that a blood transfusion from Mighty Mouse would make other mice resistant to cancer, and some mice that had this advanced cancer could get a blood transfusion from Mighty Mouse and be cured. Astonishing. That is something that I wish we could apply for people, and I think there is the potential for that.
Well, and speaking of astonishing, you've had a couple of patients who you write about who had terminal cancer treated with radiation, maybe more for palliative purposes, and it ended up curing them. Could you talk about that?
Sure. That is perhaps what got me really interested in the immunological mechanisms underlying cancer in the first place. I've had a couple of patients with advanced terminal metastatic cancer who required radiation therapy to relieve symptoms. The radiation therapy was expected to do nothing more than relieve symptoms, but it did do a lot more than relieve symptoms. In one case of a young man with advanced melanoma that had spread to his liver, lungs, and to his bones, I treated one of the bones and all of his cancer and all the other bones, all the liver lesions, all the lung lesions, and all his lymph nodes spontaneously regressed and stayed away. And that was an amazing observation called the abscopal effect. This was over 15 years ago, and there wasn't a whole lot of attention being paid to the abscopal effect, but obviously I was tremendously influenced by it, and I've been seeking an answer to that ever since, and also seeking to replicate it ever since. Today, the good news is that there are physicians and clinics that are intentionally replicating abscopal effects with some of the newer agents combined with radiation therapy.
And is it working in the almost miraculous way that you saw it work in your patient?
It's certainly not 100%, but there is a lot more conversation about the abscopal effect today than 15 or 20 years ago. So while it's not mainstream, it is something that people are seeing, believing, and paying attention to, and in some cases, replicating in the clinic.
We're talking with Dr. James Welsh right now from the Stritch School of Medicine at Loyola University Chicago. He's the author of the book Sharks Get Cancer, Mole Rats Don't, and he'll be speaking about that book at A Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison this Sunday at 2 o'clock. And let's talk a little bit about immunotherapy. Now, this is something that cancer research had delved into a bit and, in a sense, put back on the shelf in favor of other things. Now it's back. It's one of the more exciting areas, avenues for cancer research right now. What do we know about the potential of immunotherapy and the channels that science is going down right now?
Well, I have to admit that, frankly, I'm very excited about the renaissance in cancer immunotherapy. A lot of my colleagues were and remain skeptical, but that's because the immunotherapy that was tried 15, 20, 30 years ago was designed specifically to strengthen the soldiers of the immune system. We didn't understand that there were regulatory cells in the immune system that held the soldiers back. And the immunotherapy way back then strengthened the soldiers that could kill the cancer, but also strengthened the regulators that held the soldiers back. So we didn't understand that until recently. Today, the immunotherapy is designed at decreasing the potency of the regulators, the cells that hold the soldiers back. If we decrease the strength of these regulators, the strengthened army of immune cell soldiers can do what it's supposed to do, namely eradicate the cancer. We are seeing this happen with some of these new drugs called checkpoint inhibitors. And the checkpoint is basically a mechanism that slows down the immune response. By overcoming this checkpoint, by taking these breaks off, we allow the cells that want to kill the cancer to do what they want to do.
Now, looking at some of the assumptions that we have about cancer is one avenue of inquiry in your book. And one thing we think about when we talk about cancer is that, you know, it's, we assume maybe because it's a disease of mutations, when cells mutate, you may get a cancer occurrence, that this is something you're more prone to as you get older. The cancer could be considered a disease of aging. Where are you on that? Is that true?
Well, I might be in the minority in my opinion here, but I think there is a lot more to the story than just mutation theory. Sure, there needs to be certain mutations in order for cancer to occur, but I think those mutations are necessary but not sufficient. What is also necessary is a weakening of the immune system, in my opinion. And I do think that our immune system tends to weaken with age, and the classic example is the chickenpox virus being kept in check for many decades, but coming back when we're in our 50s, 60s, and 70s in the form of shingles because of that waning immunity. That waning immunity might also allow mutated cells to finally get the upper hand. So I do think that while the mutations are necessary, they are not sufficient for cancer to fully express itself. I also think that there are some examples from the animal kingdom that clearly underscore this, such as elephants, who have a lot more cells, a lot more cell divisions, and therefore a lot more mutations than humans could have, yet they don't have cancers as frequently. Whales are far bigger than elephants still, and they live 200 years in some instances. With all those cells, all those cell divisions, there must be a lot of mutations, and therefore they should all get cancer at a very early age. The fact that they don't is very curious.
Dr. Welsh, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Dr. James Welsh. His book is called Sharks Get Cancer, Mole Rats Don't, and he'll be speaking at a Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison this Sunday, June 5th at 2 o'clock.
Coming up, it's Food Friday. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we recap the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, it's time for Food Friday. Many cuisines represent a crossroads of different cultures, and Vietnamese cooking is no exception. The mix of Chinese, French, and native Vietnamese flavors and ingredients produces flavorful and often very healthy dishes.
Jacqueline An joins us now. With her mother, Helene, she wrote the cookbook An to Eat, Recipes and Stories from a Vietnamese Family Kitchen. Helene and her daughters run the House of An, a restaurant group in California. Jacqueline, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, the beginning of your cookbook, it begins with this fascinating story about how your family got into the restaurant, the culinary profession to begin with, and it was this kind of incredible fluke that ended up sort of saving you all at one point in San Francisco. But I know it's a long story, but can you give us a snapshot of what happened?
Yeah, sure. So my grandmother, well, first of all, my parents, they both come from more of an aristocratic background. And while they've always been around cooking, they never thought that would be something that would be part of their livelihood. But my grandmother, Diana, who's always been very independent, loved to travel, she actually came to the U.S. in 1968. And when she was traveling, she went to San Francisco and just fell in love with San Francisco. And at that time, it was very hard to get a visa unless you had a business. So my grandmother, being the independent and progressive person that she was, said, you know, I'm a great chef. Why not buy over this Italian deli and start the first Vietnamese restaurant? And that's how my mother got started in the restaurant business. And it became, you know, our livelihood once they came over to the U.S.
And the story of how they came to the U.S., this is at the end of the war in Vietnam. Your family came over ultimately as refugees, is that right?
Yes, they came over in 1975. My grandmother was already in the U.S. at that time, and so that, you know, helped the transition, you know, greatly, and, you know, being able to have, she already had the restaurant business at that time, so, you know, that became the family's livelihood, and that's how we got started in the restaurant business.
What kinds of stories do you have about those early days in this restaurant when you started to introduce Vietnamese style dishes into this Italian, what had been this Italian restaurant?
Yeah, that's the really funny part. So when my grandmother first bought the restaurant, and it was an Italian deli, and at that time people really didn't really know what Vietnamese food was. Was it Chinese food, you know, Asian food? They didn't know what was Vietnamese food. And so she actually kept a lot of the Italian dishes on her menu, as well as had some of the Vietnamese dishes as well. And as when my mother came over, we started adding a lot more Vietnamese dishes. And one of our most famous dish, which is the garlic noodles, and it's the most popular dish today, is because it's actually due to my mother seeing how much Americans loved Italian food, you know, love pasta, and how can she create a dish that, you know, has Vietnamese flavors, but yet, you know, was approachable, you know, to the American palate at that time. That's how our garlic noodles came to be.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about those flavors that are key to Vietnamese food? What are some of the characteristic things that we'll encounter as we cook from your cookbook?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, in terms of Vietnamese food, traditional Vietnamese food, fish sauce is something that we, you know, use a lot of. Garlic, ginger, shallots, green onion. I think those were kind of the base of Vietnamese food, traditional Vietnamese food. In terms of, if you have those ingredients, and a lot of herbs as well. We do that in a lot of our cooking, a lot of fresh herbs. Tieto is a common herb that we use, and it's actually named for one of our restaurants. But my mother used a lot of fresh herbs because it's packed with a lot of antioxidants and vitamins. And in Vietnamese cooking, because it's so hot, especially down south, you know, a lot of our food is, you know, instead of cooking the vegetables, especially down south, you're kind of having that platter of fresh herbs that you often see when you go to a Vietnamese-style restaurant.
And you write about the intersection there of Vietnamese and French and Chinese cooking, all sort of meeting in your restaurants and in Vietnamese cuisine today. Where do you see those different strands coming in?
Well, for example, with in our cookbook, and for example, Chinese influence, they dominate our country for over 1,000 years, so there's a lot of contribution from their cuisine, the wok, the use of oil and deep frying. In Vietnamese cooking, we have a couple of dishes in our cookbook that talks about stir frying and use of that. That's definitely a lot of comes from the Chinese influence in our culture. And French, I mean, French is such a big part of our cuisine. And you know, when the French was in Vietnam, Hanoi was the capital, so northern part of Vietnam. And both my parents' family were from northern Vietnam. So in terms of French cooking in our food, in our cookbook, it's heavily influenced. And, you know, the baguette, you know, French, you know, we wouldn't have banh mi if it wasn't for the French, for bringing the baguette in. We wouldn't have the great Vietnamese coffee because the French brought in, you know, the coffee bean and French coffee. And, you know, in terms of butter, using butter, we didn't have cakes and custard at that time. So, and you know, one of the dishes that I think we're going to talk today about is the banana bread, and you know, that dish is very much has you know, due to the French influence in our cooking.
We're talking to Jacqueline Ahn. She's co-author with her mother of the new cookbook, Ahn to Eat, Recipes and Stories from a Vietnamese Family Kitchen. And we want to get cooking, and you just mentioned one of the recipes we've got on our Central Time Facebook page. We'll start with dessert. I never mind doing that. Rum-soaked Vietnamese banana cake. Can you talk us through that one? What makes it special? I mean, the name I think maybe says it all, but tell us about it.
Well, I love this dish, and it's one of those dishes that, you know, you can have it hot or cold. I prefer it a little warm. You can, you know, if, if you cook it the day before, you can warm it in the microwave, or even if you have it cold, it kind of melts in your mouth. And it's so delicious. The use of coconut milk with milk just makes it a little lighter, rich but then light at the same time. I think that's what makes it so special. And, you know, I guess you can kind of say that it's a little bit like bread pudding in that kind of texture and flavor. But I think that really the coconut and the milk together just makes it very nice and light and moist.
Would you serve this as a dessert, or is this something you would have maybe with afternoon coffee?
Oh, you could both. I mean, if you want to make it a little more extra decadent, I've definitely had it with a scoop of ice cream, and that would be a dessert. You know, really, I had this so much as an afternoon snack. You know, the rum dissipates, so, you know, it's not so strong in terms of rum flavor, but we had this all the time as a snack.
Well, getting to the savory side of things, we've got another recipe we'll get to in a bit, oven-roasted lemongrass chicken. But in the technique and equipment part of the cookbook, it seems like a wok is really key to a lot of these recipes. Now, I've bought a wok before, not a very good one, and I forgot about it and ultimately got rid of it. I don't know if I want to go out and get a new one. Can I do a lot of these recipes with something other than a wok? Will you let me off the hook there?
Yes. No, you definitely can. And you know, you can just use a nice pan, a steel pan, or something that will work great as well. And Vietnamese cooking, the wok is something we use a lot, just because you can also use it for steaming. But you know, if you're just doing stir fry, then there's really not so much a need for a wok, unless you're kind of deep frying or using a lot of oil. And Vietnamese cooking doesn't require a lot of oil. So even with the black cod, which is one of the dish that is in the cookbook, we usually use a regular steel pan for that.
So let's talk about that recipe that Rob just mentioned, the oven-roasted lemongrass chicken. I love lemongrass, and I'd love to know how you get that flavor into the roast chicken. Can you walk us through that one?
Yeah, so with lemongrass, it's really important. When you're using lemongrass, to either smash it or, you know, cut it into very finely thin slices to really get the flavor and aroma out. And so in our recipe, I mean, that's one thing we do. We cut it very finely, and then we put it into a blender or cuisine art, to get out that wonderful lemongrass flavor. So that's one of the tricks for using lemongrass, is make sure you pound it. And the soft bulb part is usually what you really want to use. The hard outer leaves of the lemongrass, that's usually something you can discard in terms of when you're using it for roasting or sauteing. And then in the roasted lemongrass, and one thing so great about it is all the fresh herbs that we put in it. My mother is a student of Chinese medicine, so she loves using fresh herbs in her food, and this definitely showcases, you know, kind of her style of cooking this dish right here, with the tiacho and the Vietnamese coriander and all the different great Vietnamese herbs that we use in here.
And lemongrass, I'll admit, is something I haven't cooked with a lot. Is it pretty flexible? Can you use it in a pretty big variety of types of meat and other dishes?
Yes. Well, we also use it in our pork shoulder dish. So definitely. It's used a lot in chicken and in soups as well. But pork shoulder, you can even use it. It tastes great. We have this other dish that isn't in the cookbook, but with stir fry, like I said, you know, smash the lemongrass and cut it very finely, and stir fry it with beef, you know, with a nice filet mignon or something, and it has packed such a wonderful flavor.
We're talking right now with Jacqueline Ahn. She wrote a gorgeous new cookbook with her mother, and it's called On to Eat, Recipes and Stories from a Vietnamese Family Kitchen.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Vietnamese cuisine? Do you eat it now? Did you grow up with it? Do you have a favorite dish that you'd like Jacqueline's help in recreating at home? Or maybe questions about some of the ingredients and seasonings common in Vietnamese food? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page and get those recipes for oven-roasted lemongrass chicken and rum-soaked Vietnamese banana cake.
More of Food Friday coming up. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our Food Friday conversation with Jacqueline Ahn. She co-wrote a new cookbook with her mother, and it's called Ahn to Eat, Recipes and Stories from a Vietnamese Family Kitchen. And you can join in right now at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy the mix of cuisines, the French and the Chinese that show up in Vietnamese cooking? Is there a favorite of yours that you've tried to recreate at home? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jacqueline, your family was ahead of the curve when it came to Vietnamese recipes and restaurants. We're starting to see more and more of a couple foods out there I wanted to ask you about. First is pho, P-H-O, I think I'm saying it right. Brothy, soupy thing, often with beef, sometimes with chicken. Can you tell us a little bit about pho and what goes into it?
Pho, the cornerstone of pho is the broth. And we actually have one dish in the cookbook with the French onion pho, which is more about the broth than the noodles. So when you're making good pho, you really want to focus on the broth. And the broth has to be very clean and clear and opposed to what's another popular noodle dish, which is ramen right now, which sometimes with ramen broth it can be a lot heavier, and you kind of see that layer of fat. In order to have a very good broth, that layer of fat can't be there. So you take the time to kind of let that fat rise to the top and make sure you take out all the impurities and that fat out of the broth. And so what you're left with is this wonderful clean stock. And that's what you really want in a great pho. And in terms of ingredients, I mean, beef bones, leaves, oxtail in our beef pho soup, onions, cardamom pods, ginger, star anise, cinnamon stick. Those are kind of the basic ingredients in pho. But the north and the south makes it slightly different, and I can definitely go into that. Our style of pho in our cookbook leans a little bit more northern style. The south tends to be sweeter, so they would add in daikon or carrots to make that broth sweeter. In our pho dish in the book, I mean, we really just stick with the bones and the onions to give that sweetness to the broth.
We'll take a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Mitch on the line in Milwaukee. Mitch, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually heading to Chicago and request some excellent Vietnamese restaurants here. And I've been to Vietnam. One thing we've got to pass all to the door is your famous lemongrass soup.
Okay, I made out a couple words there. I heard you've been to Vietnam and you love lemongrass soup. I think that's what I got, Mitch. You were breaking up a little. But Jacqueline, tell us about lemongrass soup. Is that one that you're familiar with?
Yes. Yes. And lemongrass soup is more common, I think, down in the southern part of Vietnam. And the key thing when you're making lemongrass soup, again, is like I was saying earlier about lemongrass, don't just put the stock in. You know, you have to make sure you take like a heavy knife or something heavy and smash the bulb to really get out the flavors, and then use that lemongrass to cook in the soup.
Mitch, thanks a lot, and I hope you find some more of that lemongrass soup in your travels. Another dish that we're seeing more and more, in fact, a couple of food carts just around the corner here now, banh mi, the sandwich type deals you mentioned earlier, Jacqueline. Give us a little of the history and what goes into a good banh mi.
The good banh mi is the bread, and the Vietnamese banh mi is slightly different, I guess, than the French baguette you would get at a French bakery. Some Vietnamese baguette use a little bit mix of rice flour, so it's a little bit lighter, I guess. If you do a direct comparison, you might notice that the French style baguette is a little bit chewier and heavier in taste, and the Vietnamese baguette is a little bit lighter, and that's due to some people, you know, mixing it with the wheat flour and rice flour. Good banh mi is definitely having, you know, the yummy, delicious meat inside. We often use pate as an ingredient. You don't have to do that. And the pickled carrots and pickled daikon. I think that's very key into your banh mi. It adds that kind of sweet, sour tartness that makes the banh mi so special, that's so popular now.
I want to ask you about a saying that you write about, the saying that you eat with your eyes. You say you actually really eat with your nose, and that's just as important in your family. Tell us about how you guys, your family, try to make sure that the aroma is a big part of what you're cooking.
Yes, that's such a big part in our family's cooking and Vietnamese cooking in general. And that's why my mother's cuisine, you look through the recipes, so many of her use of herbs, lemongrass, tieto, all these are very fragrant herbs and spices that we use in Vietnamese cooking. And it's Vietnamese cooking, I would say, you know, as opposed to Japanese food, where it's very much, you know, the eyes, you're looking at something that's very beautifully done. Vietnamese food is more about the smell and taste. And when you're having a bowl of pho, you smell the bowl of pho first, and before actually taking a sip. So that's kind of like our philosophy in terms of eating, is smelling the aromas. Again, the lemongrass roast chicken, my best memory of it is every time my mother or grandmother is cooking it, is we can smell it throughout the whole house, and that starts to get our appetite going.
We're talking to Jacqueline Ahn. She's the co-author with her mother of the book Ahn to Eat, Recipes and Stories from a Vietnamese Family Kitchen. Back to our callers now with Jason on the line in Madison. Jason, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Jason?
So I'm engaged to a Vietnamese American woman, and so we both eat with her parents a lot, and they make amazing food. But her mom hasn't passed down as many cooking tips to us, and there's one thing that I've been really wanting to know how to make, and my fiance too. And it's a basic one, I guess. Just how do I make sticky rice?
How to make sticky rice. Jason, thanks. Maybe your mother-in-law will give that to you as a wedding present. But Jacqueline, maybe you can get ahead of that.
Well, sticky rice is a shorter grain of rice. It's sweeter. One way that we like making it, there's multiple different ways of making it, but one way you can do it is you can put it in banana leaf and steam it, and the banana leaf, you know, adds a wonderful fragrance to it. You can also add a little coconut milk in the banana, in the sticky rice, you know, soak it in coconut milk and then wrap it in the banana leaf and allow it to steam, you know, put it in a, you know, a regular steamer. You can probably just use any steamer. And that's how you want to cook the sticky rice, is you use the steamer. But yeah, you can add coconut milk if you want to, just give it a nice sweeter flavor, or just cook it as is with a little salt in it if you want to make a more savory style sticky rice.
Oh, Jason, hope that helps. It sounds like a couple of great options there for making sticky rice. And time for another caller here. We've got Art on the line next in La Crosse. Art, hello.
Hi. I have made pho at home before, and I tried to dilute the broth because I didn't have as much of the soup bones as I wanted. Mm-hmm. And then also, in the recipe I read, it said I should use a lot of salt because the noodles will soak up a lot of salt when I add them into the broth. And I don't think I use enough salt, because when I would assemble the pho, it was just, I had to continue to salt it as I ate it.
So it didn't quite work out for you, Art. And do you have any secrets for making pho at home, Jacqueline?
Well, so one thing that we actually add the salt towards the end so once you allow the bones to kind of cook in, filter the impurities. But when you're adding the salt, we like to add everything kind of towards the end. And same thing with fish sauce. When you're adding the fish sauce in our recipe, we actually add it basically once the broth is done, because fish sauce, when you cook it with fish sauce, it tends to, if you cook it for a long time, it tends to kind of add a kind of sour flavor. And that was something that my mom did not like in terms of taste palate. So I think one thing you want to do with, in terms of when you're cooking the pho, you know, roast your onions that add a lot of great sweetness. you know, if you have a lot of good bones, definitely use that. Oxtail adds a lot of flavor and sweetness as well. And add your salt towards the end so that it doesn't get too salty. And then you can really kind of, basically when it's towards the end, and you can really taste how much salt you want to use. If you put it too early, then you can get your broth too salty. You don't want
to. That's great advice. Thanks to Jacqueline An, her new cookbook written with her mother, An, to eat. Recipes and stories from a Vietnamese family kitchen. Find recipes for lemongrass chicken and rum-soaked Vietnamese banana cake on the Central Time Facebook page. It is National Donut Day on Wisconsin Public Radio. Being what it is, of course, we'd expect to see the streets littered with donuts as we approach. Donuts, as far as the eye could see, because we have them for a lot of occasions. Do we
usually
have them?
Usually for no occasion
for
at
no
all.
Occasion,
donuts,
right.
Well, sometimes for occasions. But
Friday the 13th, Thursday. Donuts happen.
Thursday, Donut Thursday.
Sometimes random donuts show up on Thursday. People's birthdays, people get a job here, people leave their job here. What happens?
Well, today there are no donuts.
No donuts.
On this National Donut Day, there are no donuts at Wisconsin Public Radio. Nary a donut to be found.
Right. So it's a poor way to celebrate. And on top of that, we're on the social media. We're on Twitter. And every other media outlet is tweeting pictures of their donuts.
Maybe we can have a virtual donut. So, Rob, if you could have any donut in the world right now, what donut would you select if they were sitting right there outside the studio?
Probably cream-filled with some chocolate on top. You?
You know what?
Like vanilla cream.
I think that I would have this one that we happened to have while we were traveling in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles. It was a mango donut, so sort of a mango
too
custard on top.
Too fancy for me. It sounds good, but too
super
fancy.
Super yummy.
Though, of course, we were talking. We did stumble onto the conclusion that we had the power to make donuts happen if we had thought of it.
Mental note for next year.
Next year.
National Donut Day.
We'll definitely remember that. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.